Lecture 24, The Renaissance Papacy.
One of the consequences of the Council of Constance was the idea of conciliarism. That is, that the Pope is ultimately responsible not just to God, but to the body of the Church acting through a council. The problem with the schism had made it quite clear that if the papacy chose not to reform itself, or if a problem with the head of the Church, such as having two popes, should arise, there had to be a mechanism to deal with it, and the schism had proved that there wasn't. Consequently, the idea was recovered and reestablished, an idea that was very old in the Church, that ultimately it was the body of the faithful acting through the representatives of the bishops and archbishops, in which the sovereignty of the Church resided. This idea of conciliarism then re-entered the papacy and caused a good deal of tension. Martin V, of course, had to agree to this because he was, after all, elected by a council. He couldn't really argue against it. But the traditions of papal theocracy and papal absolutism had been so deeply entrenched in the idea of the papacy at that point that Martin, in fact, realized that there had to be means of trying to overcome the documents that he had signed and sworn to, that ultimately the Pope would be accountable to councils. The councils themselves were to be called with some measure of regularity so that the Pope could be reviewed and held accountable. In fact, one of the decrees of the council, called frequens, frequency, indicated that these councils must be called, that it wasn't something that just could be done, but something that had to be done. The return of Martin V to Rome in 1420 allowed a certain distancing from the papacy and the idea of the council, and Martin's work was such that he really wasn't faced with any kind of serious difficulty regarding this new principle of broad sovereignty in the Church, as opposed to the idea of papal theocracy. Martin, moreover, was a very good and a very efficient pope, and the problems he faced were so large and so fundamental that the Church generally were just happy to have him there dealing with them. The reuniting of the Church, the creation of a singular papacy, and the distancing from the scandal of the schism were far more important than controlling the papacy at this point. Moreover, very few Catholics really resented what Martin was doing because he was using the money that only really began to flow slowly back into Rome for necessary things like the reconstruction of the Basilica of St. John Lateran. But he wasn't as successful in establishing papal authority outside the council simply because the memory of the schism was so powerful. Martin then essentially avoided the issue, but his successor, Eugene IV, could not. Eugene IV didn't enjoy Martin's universal support. He, after all, wasn't the pope that had ended the schism. He wasn't the pope that had returned the papacy to Rome and reunited the shepherd with his flock. Consequently, he was instantly bombarded with demands for a council so that he could be reviewed. This, of course, he largely refused to do. He, like every pope, saw that his office was determined by Christ in his charge to Peter. He saw that he was the apostolic succession from the Prince of the Apostles, answerable to no one but God. And as a result, he had a rather uncomfortable rule as pope. Another council was held at Basel, in fact, to call him to account, and the result was a new schism. An antipope was elected, and Eugenius was declared deposed. But the antipope didn't have the kind of support that he needed. Eugene had enough support to remain as pope, and the greatest effect was probably the lack of comfort in his own life as he traveled a good deal outside the city, looking for security, especially in Tuscany, spending much time in Florence. There was also another event during Eugenius's papacy that helped reinforce the position of the pope and probably saved his papal throne. It was clear that the city of Constantinople would fall to the Ottoman Turks, as we've seen, unless a major movement on the part of Western Christianity would intervene. The schism between the Orthodox and Latin churches had to be mended so that Christianity could function with one voice and refute the claims of the Ottoman Turks to rule the area around Byzantium. The result was the calling of a council in Florence. The Council of Florence was to reunite the Eastern and Western churches, and Pope Eugene IV presided over this council. The need then for a singular voice and the recognition of the importance of the event of a single church in order to try and thwart and counteract the threat of Ottoman expansion into Constantinople was enough to save Eugene. Consequently, he remained as pope. The anti-pope, though, still claimed to rule until 1449. The successor to Eugene IV was our friend Nicholas V. Nicholas we've already seen as a truly, truly great pope. He was one who was committed to the idea of restoring the papacy. He was one who was completely and altogether committed to try and establishing a new moral view of the papacy. His first claim, he said, was that he had to be a good pope. And in many ways, he was. He was to the point that the anti-pope actually resigned. The anti-pope Felix V resigned because he saw that Nicholas was such a fine leader, that he was such a holy man. Nicholas then, by the very force of his personality, was able to end this new threat of schism and reestablish the singularity of the papal office. And he deserves our respect as a consequence. In the face of these external threats, and in the world of a newly established imperial papacy in which there were no serious attempts to reduce the power of the pope, the possibility of papal malfeasance began to grow. Indeed, the memory of the schism began to fade, and the ambitions of popes and their families began to grow. We have to remember that the States of the Church, that is, the territory ruled by the pope as Bishop of Rome, was an Italian principality. And like any principality, there were issues that were political and economic as opposed to religious. Consequently, we have to remember that complex dual role the pope fulfilled. He was both the head of the church and consequently a priest and Irenic and dedicated to peace. He was also a prince who had territory to protect, who had economic interests, and who had a family to care for. And indeed, what we see growing after the pontificate of Nicholas V is increasingly an interest on the part of individual popes to use the institution of the church and its wealth and the authority that the pope had over the papal states to build a dynastic kingdom or principality for members of their family. After the crowning of the pious Nicholas V, there was hope, but with his successors, that hope began to fade, that the papacy could be a purely spiritual operation, a purely spiritual office in which the role of the pope could have such moral authority that it wouldn't be necessary to resort to arms. Nicholas, then, was a remarkable man. He didn't have remarkable successors, at least not in terms of the holiness and sanctity of his personal life. Sixtus IV, whom we've seen as one of the great builders of Rome, one of the great contributors to the reestablishment of the dignity of the city, was also one of the worst in terms of papal nepotism, that is, the support of his family at the expense of the church. We've seen Sixtus IV's attempt to create a principality for his nephew, which resulted in the War of the Pazzi conspiracy and the murder of Giuliano de' Medici. But we also must see that his other nephew was given the richest sees in all of Europe, a man so unsuited to ecclesiastical life that he was a living scandal. It was said in popular rumor that this archbishop had over 100 mistresses whom he would dress like queens and parade through the city. He died at the age of 28, the people of Rome said, from sexual excess. These are the people that Sixtus IV wanted to promote, simply because they were members of his family. The use, then, of the church in order to enrich papal families was something that was becoming a growing problem. It was reinforced with the election of Innocent VIII Cibo in 1484. Innocent VIII was a lovely man. He was funny. He was charming. He was a delight to be with. He liked good company, good food. He was a large man, good wine, and he adored his children. He was an ideal family man. He had several children whom he not only acknowledged, but scandalized even Rodrigo Borgia by presiding over their marriages himself in front of the high altar at St. Peter's. He also was not interested in work of any kind. He had no real interest in art or culture, although he did make two important contributions to Rome. It was he who built the beautiful Belvedere, that belvedere up the side of the Monte Mario that would ultimately link the Vatican Palace with the Belvedere. He also had Pollevuolo build his tomb, a tomb so beautiful and so elegant that it was one of the few objects removed from old St. Peter's to be established in new St. Peter's, where it is to this day. But generally, his interest was in enjoying life, and that largely precluded work. So he essentially turned the church over to the Florentines to run. This was because not only was he himself a Tuscan from Siena, a family of the immensely rich of Cibo bankers, but he married his son to the daughter of Lorenzo de' Medici the Magnificent. And with his close family connection with Florence, he simply turned the church over to the Florentines and said, "You take care of it. You're good at this sort of thing. And leave me alone so I can just indulge myself and enjoy my family." Innocent VIII then was not a bad man, but he was a kind of moral vacuum, and this permitted those with negative moral qualities to rise because there was nothing really, not even an example, to restrain them. His papal vice chancellor was Rodrigo Borgia, and this enormously rich ecclesiastic would ultimately be his successor. And it was in the environment of Innocent VIII that really allowed the Borgias to become established. Alexander VI Borgia succeeded Innocent VIII in 1492, and he literally purchased the papacy. As vice-chancellor, he had responsibility for all of the offices of the church, which meant that he could take a fee from almost every action that the church took. He used this enormous wealth in order to bribe cardinals to elect him to the See of St. Peter. He'd been made a cardinal by his own uncle, Calixtus III, the first Borgia Pope, and although he was an extraordinarily skilled administrator, in many ways he was a brilliant chief operating officer of the church, he had absolutely no ecclesiastical vocation whatsoever. This was clear from the circumstances of his life. His primary mistress, Venozza Catanei, gave him four children. Now, again, this is an odd situation because the Pope not only refused to hide his relationship with Venozza Catanei, but actually celebrated it. She was given a great palace in Rome. She was given a position of authority. In fact, she was often referred to as the Queen of Rome. She was also greatly beloved because she was extremely kind to the poor, and she was a model, in fact, of wifely duty, despite the fact that she was conveniently married to somebody else and simply functioned as the Pope's mistress. But it wasn't really the relationship with his mistresses, Venozza Catanei, and then later in his life, the beautiful and perfect Giulia Farnese. Just as an anecdote, Giulia Farnese was known as the Bride of Christ. She was a teenager, about 16, and the most beautiful woman in Italy. When she captured the attention of the elderly Rodrigo Borgia, Alexander VI, she became his mistress, and it was during pillow talk that she convinced Alexander that her brother should perhaps be raised to the cardinalate, which he was. He was known as the Cardinal of the Skirts because of the way he got his office, but that cardinal became Pope Paul III, the cardinal, the pope who called the Council of Trent, and one of the great popes of the 16th century. So it's ironic that often these insalubrious and uncanonical means could actually produce great popes. But it's not Giulia Farnese, but the children of Venozza Catanei that really brought the moral reputation of the papacy to its lowest point. First, there was Alexander VI himself. Alexander had no sense of propriety. He was extremely close to his only daughter, Lucrezia Borgia. She lived in the papal apartments where no women were supposed to be present. He was extremely physically affectionate with her, which scandalized the court and led to rumors, which are almost certainly untrue, that father and daughter were lovers. But her husbands had a habit of dying under curious circumstances or of being embarrassed publicly. She was first married to a member of the Sforza family of Milan because the papacy needed an alliance with Milan. But after that alliance was no longer necessary, the Pope declared that the marriage was canonically invalid and annulled it. He did this because he said the marriage had never been consummated, despite the fact that poor Sforza and Lucrezia said in public that indeed it had been. The Pope said, well, I know better, and it hasn't been, so I've annulled the marriage, which, of course, made the Sforza extremely embarrassed. But it was worse for her second husband, who was the son of the King of Naples, the Duke of Biscilia. He was married canonically and legitimately to Lucrezia, and the marriage was indeed consummated, but then he became unnecessary, and she was needed again for another alliance. So he was attacked by professional murderers on the steps of St. Peter's Basilica. But the murderers weren't quite as good at their job as they had promised, and he was only wounded. The Pope then had his son-in-law brought to the papal apartments and to be cared for by his personal physician. Well, the wounded Duke was found strangled the next morning. Again, an occupational hazard of marrying into the Borgias. Her third marriage to the Duke of Ferrara, though, proved to be not only lasting, but extremely happy. And Lucrezia Borgia became the model duchess, kind to the poor, free with alms and charity, and a very fine woman. It wasn't her fault that she had the father and brothers that she did, and I think she essentially was just a nice Spanish girl who did what she was told. Alexander VI's sons, though, were a greater problem. His eldest son, Juan, was to be the captain general of the church. He was to lead the armies that would then ultimately create a Borgia kingdom out of the papal patrimony in central Italy. The second son, Cesare, was to be a future pope. He was put into the sacred college while still a teenager, and the pope, using his dispensing power, simply declared him to be legitimate, because illegitimate men were not permitted ordination as priests. But Juan Borgia, who had a reputation for lustfulness, was found stabbed floating in the Tiber one morning. Could have been anyone. There were so many husbands and brothers who could have wanted this to happen to Juan Borgia, but all of the evidence points to his younger brother Cesare, who probably arranged to have his brother murdered. The reason being that Cesare had no desire to be a priest whatsoever. He, in fact, was, I think, a certifiable psychopath. He wanted to be a soldier. He quite liked killing, and he wanted to do as much of it as he could. So he probably had his brother murdered, so his father would require him to leave the priesthood in the sacred college and then lead the papal armies. And that's exactly what happened. Alexander VI simply reversed his order that his son be considered legitimate, making him illegitimate once more, forcing his resignation from the sacred College of Cardinals, and Cesare Borgia became the captain general of the church. Cesare then, with his faithlessness, with his brutality, with his relentless cruelty, became not just an example of terror in Italy, he became an example of everything that perhaps was morally wrong with the papacy, because he was naturally associated with his father. Cesare's campaigns, we've seen him in Urbino and his lying to Guidobaldo. We can see him in the terrible acts of the massacre at Sinigaglia, where he questioned one of his condottieri, one of his mercenary captains' loyalty. So he simply invited them all to a feast, and while they were eating, he had his assassins come out from behind the arrases and murder them all. If you're not quite sure which one to get, take them all, and the problem is solved. Dead men tell no tales. He was a psychopath, he was a dangerous man, and he was a brilliant military commander simply because of his ruthlessness. But despite his success in war, the moral role of the papacy was reduced to a level that could not really fall any lower. The papacy now was at a level where it would be very difficult for it to recover quickly. Rodrigo Borgia, moreover, who was in many ways respected as an administrator, the people of Rome did quite well as a consequence because he ran the city extremely effectively. The church was administered brilliantly, maximizing income, but the money was spent on war and on aggrandizement of his family. The only great building that he engaged in was the decoration of the so-called Borgia apartments in the Apostolic Palace, bringing Pinturicchio to come and paint the ceiling, where you can see to this day not only the Borgia bulls, but also the portraits of the members of the family. So look up in the ceiling of the Borgia apartments and look for the figure of St. Catherine with her blonde hair, and you'll see a portrait of Lucrezia Borgia. The position of the papacy then was in a very, very, very perilous state. It's not an accident, as we'll see, that Savonarola in Florence called for a crusade to cleanse the church, to call the Pope the Antichrist. It's not an accident when Charles VIII invaded Italy in 1494 that he was fulfilling the prophecy of the new Charlemagne to cleanse the church, to allow for the second coming and the uniting of the world under the Roman Church for the salvation of all mankind. These prophecies came about in part because of the moral degradation of the papacy and consequently, by extension, a sense of the moral turpitude of the church itself. The conclave at the end of Alexander VI's reign produced a remarkable man, the nephew of Pope Sixtus IV, the nephew who became Pope Julius II. Julius chose his name to honor Julius Caesar, because Alexander VI had chosen his name to honor Alexander the Great. These were hardly biblical, ecclesiastical, or sanctified names, both being pagan conquerors rather than being Christian heroes. Julius II had been the chief opponent of Alexander VI and had spent, as a consequence, much of his life in exile. He hated the Borgias with a passion that is almost impossible to describe. He refused to live in the Borgia apartments because he'd wake up in the morning and see their portraits on the ceiling and he'd see the Borgia bull everywhere. So he caused Bramante to build a new wing that would link the Belvedere of Innocent VIII to the Apostolic Palace, and there would be new rooms built, a new Apostolic Palace, a huge extension of the creation of an enormous courtyard, the courtyard of the Belvedere. And there would be new rooms that would be decorated by the greatest artists of all time. We'll see Raphael painting the stanze, those rooms for Julius II, especially the Stanza della Signatura, the room of the signature, which was to be Julius's library, on whose walls was painted the School of Athens, representing human knowledge and pagan wisdom, and on the other, the Disputation over the Holy Sacrament, representing revealed truth and the Catholic faith. Also, it was Julius II who called in his interior decorator, not just Raphael, but Michelangelo. He wanted to decorate the vault, the ceiling of that chapel that his uncle had built, the Sistine. It was covered merely with blue paint and gold stars and was inappropriate for the papal chapel. So Michelangelo then painted that ceiling that today is one of the great moments in the entire history of human creation. Julius II, then, was perhaps the greatest patron of art of the 16th century, because what he did was superb, and what he did has lasted. Raphael was his decorator in his private apartments, and Michelangelo painted his ecclesiastical space. But also, he wanted a tomb that would live up to his reputation of himself as a great conqueror and a great man. Julius was a warrior pope. He was known as the Papa Terribile, the terrifying pope, because of his power and his authority. A man in his 60s, he still walked with common soldiers up to his waist in snow. He said often that he preferred the smell of gunpowder to the smell of incense. He dressed like a Roman emperor in armor covered with the yellow cloak of the papacy. He sold cardinals' hats for huge amounts to raise money to fight his wars. And at the same time, he patronized art. He also imposed order on the city. He finally tamed the great Roman barons and made the Pope the real ruler of the city in every way, something for which the Roman families never forgave him. He also did some rebuilding in the city. He built the Via Giulia, perhaps the most beautiful street in Rome, in order to ease the congestion in that part of the city leading to the Ponte Sisto, the bridge that his uncle had built across the Tiber. But his single act was not his conquest, his capturing of Bologna, his extension of papal rule. It wasn't his calling of Michelangelo to make a huge bronze statue of himself to be put on the facade of the Basilica of San Petronio in Bologna that ultimately was melted down and made into a canon named Julia. It was the building of St. Peter's. The ancient Basilica of St. Peter, that church built by Constantine over the burial place of the apostle, was 1,200 years old. It was actually in bad shape. It had been heavily used. Hundreds of thousands of people streamed in and out of it every year. It was in need of refurbishment, or it was in need of replacement. Even Nicholas V, that great Irenic pope, considered pulling the church down and building a new one that would allow for even more pilgrims, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims who came to the burial place of Peter. But it took someone of the personality of Julius II to actually do it. And the circumstances reflect his personality. The intention of the new church wasn't just to honor St. Peter, but to honor his successor. He called upon Michelangelo to build the greatest tomb since antiquity, to carve a tomb that would rival that of King Mausolaus of Halicarnassus, whose mausoleum, named after him, became the ideal of all great classical tombs. Because the church was to be a Greek cross, in which the nave and transept were of equal length, and where they met there was to be a great dome. That was to cover the burial place of Peter, and above it was to be the tomb of Julius II, made by Michelangelo. Well, Julius needed more money for war than for art on occasion. The tomb was never made, although Michelangelo did the figure of Moses for it, which adorns the now rather simple tomb of Julius II in the church of San Pietro in Vincoli. The tomb was never built, but the church was. Julius' intent is that he would build the greatest church in Christendom, the greatest church that ever was, as it is to this day. When he pulled down the old basilica, he, a man in his late 60s, jumped into the pit in order to put a gold medal of himself underneath the huge piers that would support the dome, so that if that church should ever be pulled down at some point in the future, they'd find the medal of Julius II. The new St. Peter's was to be an enormous building. It was to be the central place, not just of Catholicism, but a place to recognize Julius's place in history itself. It was to take 130 years to build, and in order to pay for it, Julius permitted the German Dominicans to sell indulgences in Germany, and one of the German monks who felt that this was inappropriate was Martin Luther, connecting, of course, the events of the Reformation to the building and the cost of St. Peter's. Julius' successor, with a very short reign in between, was the second son of Lorenzo de' Medici, who became Pope Leo X. He was one of the great patrons of art as well, one of the most civilized and cultivated and polished of men. He was young when he was elected pope, just 37. He wasn't expecting to be elected pope, and when he was, he literally skipped out of the conclave, saying, "Now that God has given us the papacy, let's enjoy it." And so he did. He not only continued the patronage of Raphael in the Stanze, but also he continued the building of St. Peter's. He continued the work that Julius began, and he began his own interests, particularly music and books, but also painting and art. Raphael was his close friend, and those in his court also cultivated artists, because it was the most civilized place, almost, in Europe, that very, very polished and elegant papal court of Leo X, de Medici. He also, though, was guilty of nepotism, even though he himself hated war and was quite incapable of imagining leading soldiers. He was very, very large and had difficulty walking on occasion. But he felt he had to overthrow the Duke of Urbino, Francesco Maria della Rovere, as we've seen, so he would have a place for his own family to put their surplus children as rulers. And he used his authority to return his family to the rule of Florence, from which they had been expelled in 1494, and to which he felt his obligation was to return them. By the time of his death in 1521, then, the role of the papacy was not one of spiritual power and authority, but one of moral degradation, although a place of great beauty and elegance. He died in 1521, the very year that Martin Luther was excommunicated. Leo had seen the Lutheran revolt, but he refused to take it seriously. He thought it was just another struggle among religious orders. He was too interested in art and culture to take this questioning Augustinian monk very seriously. What he did do then was fail to recognize the church was being challenged, that the moral authority of the church was in fact weakened, and that he was contributing to it rather than addressing the problem. But nevertheless, Rome remains a much more beautiful place as a consequence.